Red 5, I'm going in.
Stay in attack formation.
Covering tonight Andor season 2 episodes 1 through 3, so the first of 4 arcs that have dropped, and we're recording this on Sunday night after it had aired, so in a few nights we'll have the second batch of episodes, but we're just going to cover these first 3 for now, which picks up a year after the end of the last season and kind of catches us up on where everyone's been, all of our like main characters. So obviously, like, it's Cassian Andor. He has a whole kind of story that then connects to the rest of the Ferrix crew later on. And the Ferrix crew is on like a wheat planet, right? Every planet in Star Wars is like a single biome, but it's like Space Nebraska, right? and then we have like Mon Mothma's having the wedding of her daughter, which was at the end of the last season that was being set up, which was like soft extortion, right? Or that was the price of her getting money to fix her money problems, was having to get money from the guy who then used his son as the cost of that for the daughter.
Leverage.
Yep. And Luthen's there at the wedding. I think he like finagled himself into it. Like, I don't
yeah, she clearly wasn't expecting him.
Yeah. So he,
and she wasn't thrilled that he was, yes, there.
Right. And Vel was there too, and then Cinta, we find out, was there too, because Vel's trying to find out where Cinta is from Luthen, and Luthen's like, I don't know, but he does. Clea was there too, but then she got out of there because she was trying to keep up with Cassian's mission, and she couldn't get like a broadcast out or whatever. And then there's Cyril and Dedra off to the side, kind of catching up with them /ISB/Krennic. So there's a lot going on in these three episodes, but when you take it as like a long movie, it kind of flows more or less smoothly, I'd say. They do a lot of cutting. Maybe sometimes where I'm like, ah, no, go back to that, you know. but they kind of have to cram a lot in, I guess. So I guess, how do you want to tackle this? Do you want to do like kind of the major story arcs in their orders, or like not really?
Yeah.
So it's because I can't always quite distinguish between the three when they're all like released at once like this, and you kind of watch it as a group. I don't remember where each one ends and which one begins, you know.
But, yeah, I think following each arc, each through line.
Well, let's start with, I guess, because it's like Empire Strikes Back style, like opening sequence, which is like Cassian stealing the TIE fighter, the TIE Avenger,
TIE Interceptor.
Yeah, it's like this advanced prototype model. So he's on Sinar, which is like Sinar Fleet Systems that makes the TIE fighters. He's at like the test facility, and that whole like action sequence is getting away, right, with his TIE fighter, and it starts with like a very Luthen-esque speech a little bit to like the Imperial that he kind of recruited,
mm-hmm,
to like get in on this to like help him get this thing stolen. So far, we have not seen what happened to her as a result of that, if she kept her cover or what. But he obviously, like, it ended last season with him, like, bring me in or kill me. And Luthen's obviously trained him a little bit, right? And he's doing these missions independently. And for some amount of time, he's been, like, undercover as an Imperial test pilot. And that's his cover story. And he's got this Imperial technician, I guess. She's not, like, a, you know, Kool-Aid drunk person. Sorry, as I can tell. She's just, like, a tech or something. But, and she might not even be Imperial. She might just be like a corporate employee of like Sinar Fleet Systems. That's just like a contractor, right? Like a defense contractor person or something. But somehow she's doing something to the cockpit at the beginning, which I think was like making it so he could use it perhaps. Or it's just showing us like that sweet set piece of that TIE fighter. So they use that.
Yes.
So they have, I think, a full scale practical, like full size model they're using in the show, and then obviously there's like CG stuff, but like I think it's a real tangible, and it really feels like solid and stuff. It doesn't look cheap or toyish. It's like this really cool, like, ship. It's so cool. But yeah, it kind of starts with a bang because he has to like shoot his way out, you know, which we saw some of that in the promos and the trailers. But then there's like a whole chase that's very, very much like kind of like Empire Strikes Back with like flying through the asteroid belt kind of thing. Slash like the pod race. It reminded me of that too, similar to the pod race. But that was kind of an exciting way to open it. He gets chased by two other kind of experimental TIE fighters, which I think were from Rebels, right? I think the TIE fighters that were chasing him were the ones that were in Rebels. They were also like an experimental kind, which is kind of cool to see those. I forgot what they're called. I'm sure Justin or David could tell us what those were called. But I recognized them. They weren't the ones from like Rogue One that are like, they have like the wings that are like this, and they're like
curved.
Scarif. And they're not full-on TIE interceptors. They're like, they looked like small versions of like Darth Vader's TIE fighter, kind of. But anyway, there was just two of them chasing him, and they both like he found a way to like use the rocks of the environment to get out of that. But then yeah, he's supposed to land at like a rendezvous point and then hand off to another pilot who would take it the rest of the way to somewhere we don't know where. But then yeah, that whole plan gets derailed once he lands. But I guess before we go to that, what do you think of that kind of opening sequence and like this, especially like the kind of the speech, which they had that 1 minute clip of that speech in one of the promos, but it just works. I think overall is a good way to start the tone.
No, I thought it was great that they chose more or less of an action sequence, yeah. Like a very immediately recognizable, you know, like from that opening shot, you're like Star Wars. It's clear. And I like that it jumped right into the action more or less, which I think is a good way to like grab people and like, you know, get their attention. Because I think, you know, obviously the rest of the episodes are a bit more methodical. But I thought that it looked amazing. I thought that it set the tone of humanizing everybody that's involved. Obviously Cassian, but also even this technician. I thought that that dialogue was fascinating. Like she was even saying like, well, I kind of like it here. Like I enjoy my job. I'm kind of like freaking out a little bit. Like it was very, like the conversation felt like real. It felt like the kind of conversation that would happen in that situation. And I thought that Cassian's, like his, unlike Luthen, I feel like Cassian is very, I think he genuinely cares about that person. I think that he's, you know, we don't get a backstory, so we don't know all of the things that are going on. But just based on the scene, I thought it was very effective in terms of, number one, showing how Cassian has become a true believer.
Yeah.
To the point where he can, like, you know, counsel and advise people who are involved. I thought that his speech was convincing. Like, like, you know, this is basically he was saying, like, yeah, no, this is you're following your truth, and that's the most important thing, which is a touchy thing because, right, it's like, it's not like, you know, it's not like she's gambling with money. She's gambling with her life.
Yeah.
And he's very convinced. I mean, he's number one, like, hey, I'm all in. I'm a true believer. So everything he says has weight.
Yeah.
Because he is now, you know, officially in the rebellion. But and I thought that
to some degree, he is manipulating her and kind of pushing her, right? To some degree.
To a degree, but I didn't get the impression like Luthen to me comes across as someone who will say whatever, you know, like when he had that conversation in season one with that one Imperial who was kind of hesitant. Remember that? Like he was like, oh, I don't know if I can do this. I got a family, blah, 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 my job. And he was like, you know, he kind of just bullied him, like, or attempted to bully him. And I thought that Cassian came across as more sincere. Like, obviously he needs her to follow through, even though at that point, like they were pretty much done. But I thought that that was a very effective mix of having a very appropriate conversation that fit with the rest of the episodes, I thought. in terms of setting the tone for like what the stakes are for each person that's involved, and how things, you know, what the risks are, and what the thought process might be of someone who's like in, but like struggling with, you know, some of the dangers or some of the, you know, finer points of being involved. And I thought that was a great mix of like very cool set pieces, very cool action sequences with that conversation in it. I thought that was a great opening sequence. I thought that was perfect. Like, I thought that was excellent. And I thought it was also, it was interesting to see then when he gets to what we know is Yavin, that then he encounters a very different group of rebels.
So we can talk about that. I think it's the end of episode two when he finally leaves that we see that it's Yavin, because we can see the temple and like the, you know, the yellow or the orange planet. Yeah, it's a planet, because I think Yavin's like a moon of the planet,
A
gas giant.
gas.
But we're like, oh, interesting. So like that's like, you know, obviously like a, it's, I don't think it's a base, but I think it's like a, you know, I liken it to like a pirate cove. Like pirates have these like hideout spots right in the Caribbean, and I think this is like maybe a known out of the way place that scoundrels use or whatever, and the rebels were using it as like the transfer point. So yeah, when he gets there, which I love how they show him like kind of struggling to use, like especially to like land, he's just like barely landing it, and then he's supposed to like, yeah, meet whoever he came, I guess he came with somebody, and because he had his own ship there, right? Or was it the
Well,
one
he
that
had left. I think he had left when he left there. I think there was a pilot was there, and I don't know why that had to happen, but he came back and thought he was going to meet the pilot,
To
but the
transfer
pilot
off.
was gone, and the
But like
rebels
to
that were there.
compartmentalize it, so like that one person, like he wouldn't be able to blow the whole thing if he got captured. Like the trail would end with this like Yavin meetup, and like he wouldn't, even Cassian wouldn't know like where the TIE fighter is going to be ending up going. Like that's just operational security. That's probably why they did that. Slash, like he said, like I wasn't trained to fly this thing, right? Like, or this isn't what I trained about. So like he was only trained, I guess, to break it out, not to like navigate it to wherever he was supposed to go.
I thought I love that was the case, because I think it meshed very well with the kind of the portrayal, at least for sure on the Yavin storyline, but even in the other storylines, like the rebellion is messy, it's not super coordinated, it's kind of like very, you know, grassroots,
That's what
no
I think is the
glamour.
point of that entire first two episodes, the whole Yavin sequence. And like, yeah, it did take two episodes, but it's to like really highlight like the very sad state of the starting point, where 4 years later they're like all in that Yavin temple, like completely, and it finally takes like literally like at the last minute possible, they finally come together and like, okay, let's go to Scarif, right? They were even fighting up to that point. Remember in the big council room? Like the idea of like, yeah, this is like a, you know, some rebel brigade that he knows about, but they don't know him. And even they're fighting because all you got to do is introduce some like scarcity, right? Like 3 days without food, stressful situation, little hope, and everyone's at each other's throats and splitting off, making camps, like having a standoff. Like it doesn't take much. Doesn't take much to descend into that. And then to some degree, like I think what I took away from all that was, so Cassian like showed like his, you could say, leadership, like with the Imperial tech earlier, but then like he almost, like it's a failure all around. Like he didn't quite seize the opportunity to like bring everyone together and like, guys, quit fighting. Like maybe he was close, but then like at a certain point he was just like, okay, when they're just like distracted, I'm gonna like get out of here. And then he just like left them. So like he, in a sense, like failed them in a way too. Like he abandoned what is supposed to be his compatriots, right? Like they're all on the same team, but he just like bailed on them because they obviously
Well,
outgunned the TIE fighter.
I
But
thought that was I liked that that was the way it was portrayed,
yeah.
because like you said, I think like it gives the rebellion space to evolve into a more organized group. Even though in Rogue One there's still splinters, but I thought that, you know, it was just very well, like how he just kind of drops into this chaotic situation, you know, that's how it would probably be, like You
don't know.
if everything just went smoothly, there isn't. It reminded me somewhat of like, I don't know if you've ever seen, it's an older movie about Che Guevara, and it like kind of shows like how messy the Cuban Revolution was. Like, you know, it wasn't all glitz and glamour. And like, I think that in Star Wars in general, the rebellion is still portrayed as like, you know, a ragtag group of rebel fighters and so on. But this made it much more like very real, very much more like this is what it would actually be like.
Yeah.
You know,
a bunch of doofuses kind of feel like stone.
Well, and like, you don't even know who these people are, you know, who knows what their background is. You know, Luthen doesn't seem to be super, you know, like he will get people to do what he wants, even if regardless. But I thought that the whole sequence, if we just, you know, kind of dovetail off it, like the whole sequence on Yavin, right? It's like, where it's like, you know, even though these people have made a decision to make a sacrifice, you know, if you're hungry and thirsty enough, like that's real too. And that was so real that, right, it made it hard for them to stay focused on the mission because they're like, we're stranded.
Yeah.
We have no food. We have no water. And for whatever reason, they didn't trust that Cassian was.
Yeah. Well, yeah, one side had the pilot, one side had the ship, and the people with the ship don't know how to use it. But they can't just kill everybody over there because that would kill the pilot and then everyone's stranded. So it's like a lot of game theory and Prisoner's Dilemma stuff going on, like pretty smart. Like it like naturally evolved. It just kind of found yourself in that situation. It wasn't like forced or something. It wasn't like the Spider-Man meme where they're all just like sitting there shooting at each other. And so a funny behind the scenes thing I found out later is that the two kind of leaders of each faction are Tony Gilroy's son and like, what do you say? His like niece's husband. And he got the idea for this scene because he wrote all these episodes, these first three, from like, they were having some kind of dinner, like a family gathering, and everyone was like a little bit drunk, and like his son. And then his, like, that would be like his, so his, what would a niece's husband be to a son? Like, let's say a cousin or something, an in-law. They just like kind of were fighting, like bickering, like half drunk and bickering. And that kind of sparked the idea for this. And they both ended up, like, he ended up just casting both of them for this. So that's who those two are. The two leaders on each side are like both in his family as like Tony Gilroy's son and like,
right, brother.
And yeah. And like, so like that's real, like realistic, like they just got to like kind of ham it up a little bit and like play like, you know, Star Wars, like rock, paper, scissors. And like,
oh, that was
with whatever. I was like, wow, this is wild.
That was,
they're playing that
absolutely.
He's just like sneaking away, like while they're like distracted playing this game or whatever. It's so funny.
That the way they set that up was, and it was the perfect example of like how the three episodes incorporated humor without it feeling out of place or feeling like distracting. I mean, when they like the way that came, like, you know, they're all standing there, they all got their guns, okay, put your weapons down, and da 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 da.
Yeah.
And then they start playing galactic rock, paper, scissors. Like, that was absolutely hilarious.
I laughed when they're first examining the TIE fighter before they like before the fight breaks out. They're like, their pilot is in there. She ends up getting killed in the first like firefight, but like she's in there trying to, and she's like, "This is all different. Like, I thought I knew a TIE fighter, but this is totally different." And then like the one guy pokes in, and he's like, "Is there any food in there?" You know, because they're all hungry. It's just funny. Like, yeah, there was definitely some humor, and then. Obviously, like, the rock, paper, scissors game gets, like, interrupted. Well, I guess before that, when there's, like, a standoff, like, there was somebody...
Creature comes out.
The no man's land. And then, like, so, like, different sides are, like, crawling to, like, scope out the other one. And, like, yeah, one of them, it's, like, an Aliens / Jurassic Park moment where, like, they think, they, like, oh, here's my guy. Like, oh, it's just the
it's
foot.
It's just a foot. Yeah.
And then, it turns out it's the creature that was in like episode 2, Attack of the Clones, like in the arena. It's like the one that Anakin tamed. It's one of those beasts or whatever. That's the thing that like just jumps out and like causes the absolute mayhem that is the final straw for Cassian to just get out of there and abandon them all, I guess, there. So who knows? They're probably all dead, I guess. Who knows? Obviously, they'll be back there at some point, but who knows?
I thought it was part of the funny part of what made that whole sequence funny was how Cassian was reacting, right? When it was raining and he's like, maybe you should put out a tarp to catch some water, that's hilarious. Like he was thinking clearly and these people are all just out of their minds. But I thought that the even though I've heard some criticism that like this seemed like a kind of a pointless part of the storyline. But I thought that it was very effective when they were switching back and forth, because right, like the whole part of one of the pivot points of the whole episode is that all the other arcs, right, like are wondering where's Cassian? Is he okay? Did he get the ship? When is he coming back home to Min Rao? So I thought that was all very effective in sense of like creating it's the classic, classic heist thing where it's like, okay, well, like whenever you have a heist movie and there's like a rendezvous point, and then you're like, where are they? Are they here? And I thought that was all very well done. I thought it was a good way to show
how the rebellion's not organized. Like you can't just have one character just say like, oh, we're not organized. It's like, let's see how that looks right now. And it's pretty sad, That's really smart.
And I think it just created the tension that was needed for the rest of the storyline, other storylines. And I thought that it, it's like Cassian's 100% in, he's a true believer, but that doesn't change the fact that the rebellion is messy. And he has to deal with that on the fly, which I think is part of what, like I said, I think in Star Wars, in the rest of Star Wars, there are definitely like the Endor sequences on Return of the Jedi, the process is messy and they run into obstacles and that's fine. But I thought that was very appropriate and very effective and funny and high stakes and just overall very well done. And I thought that, obviously that storyline kind of ends after the second episode because then Cassian's on his way to the farm planet.
So we can leave a pin in that for when we get back to that and tie that back up. So I guess next would be, let's do Mon Mothma and the planet?
The wedding?
Yeah.
Chandrila,
yep. So we get to see that, which I don't think we've ever seen on screen before, the planet Chandrila. We've heard about it. She's having the wedding. Luthen's there. Bell's there. Cinta's there. And they're all wondering like where he is. It starts with like a really long one take tracking shot, right? To like show off that whole like set basically, which like House of the Dragon did the same thing when you first see like the Red Keep, they do like this really long, like when she's carrying her newborn baby all throughout thing. They did the same thing there. That was a cool shot. She doesn't know Luthen's there. She's surprised to see him. And he's like, they have like this banter, right? About like, I just love all the subtext. Like there's what they say through it. Like they're lying through a smile or less like, if like somebody else is there that's not supposed to be there, then they have to like play nice and like keep up the act, but they're still like talking to each other in code basically. And then they like drop the affect in the minute that they can. There was like a part where she was like, she's like, walking and then she has to like grin at somebody and then just like back to like sad and then like grin sad and like she's not enjoying herself and like she doesn't like the situation.
Well, it was already like we established in season one that she really didn't want this to happen, that she wasn't a big fan of this arranged marriage. And the other family tensions that were existent in season one are still there in season two. And I thought that the entire wedding story arc from episode one to the end of the third episode was the strongest and most well-executed storyline, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Because the primary thing was Mon Mothma, right? Like, here she is. I thought the first thing that was interesting was, which was established, I think, a little bit in season one, but it starts with, Chandrila, the Mothma estate. You know, it's like, here's this woman who is part of Chandrilan, elite, mm-hmm. very wealthy, very connected, very comfortable, and yet she has made,
Hey.
Hey.
Konnichiwa.
Oh, Justin joining us. Awesome.
That doesn't look, that looks home? Like your looks apartment, like not Japan.
Nope. I just got home, so.
Wow.
Like just this minute?
Well, a couple hours ago, actually, Jake picked me up around noon. So I'm still kind of suffering through time lag right now.
Is your body thinking it's night or morning, or what time does your body think it is?
Well, I already kind of woke up, in Japan around, 7 a.m. and then I left around 11, and then I got back here. It was around like 9 a.m. again.
Oh boy.
So my body's just like really going like, what the heck's going on?
Oh yeah. That'll take some time to recover from.
Mm-hmm.
So we covered like the opening sequence. We covered the part, basically the entire part on Yavin, the whole like rebel, the proto rebellion fight that they were having, like all that. And then we just moved over to the like Mon Mothma wedding sequence storyline. And then we'll cover later like Cyril and Dedra, of course, and then the whole like the Ferrix crew on the wheat planet, and then the final conclusion on that planet. So like we're gonna save that, I guess, that for last. So you joined us just as we were getting into the Mon Mothma wedding part, the whole storyline.
Oh, okay.
Aaron, you were saying that it's like that. You were saying that this was the strongest part for you as far as execution and concept and like tension or whatever.
Yeah,
obviously interpersonal more than anything else.
I thought that the way that it, Mon Mothma's character to me is the most interesting in terms of like what she's dealing with and what her situation is. Like she's someone from privilege, someone who has wealth, who has power, who has, connections. And she's, she could just as easily have her husband's attitude, which is basically like, well, just play the game, go with the flow, whatever.
It's like eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we die. Kind of like happy go lucky.
Yeah. And I thought that,
having like a carefree attitude towards life. Yeah.
I thought that whole opening setup, right? Like with her, she's carrying so many different tensions, right? There's the tension, even if the rebellion was completely out of the picture, right? She's at this wedding for her daughter to marry this like scummy guy's son. Mm-hmm. She's doesn't think it's a good idea. And yet there she is.
With Perrin, and like they don't have a great relationship, and she's worried that like these two teenagers are not going to be able to go the distance. Like, at the base layer, she's just a parent worried about her underage daughter getting
married. Well, she's a woman. She's a woman who has her own, career.
Yeah.
She's a very powerful individual, and yet her family is falling apart.
Yeah.
And so her family situation is very dicey, very, very much of a burden on her, mm-hmm. her marriage, her relationship with her daughter, and so on. And then you add to that that she's putting her life on the line to support Luthen and the rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have her first conversations with Is it Taya?
Tacoma.
Tacoma.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you see that start to unravel.
Because he's bearing all the like financial stress of like him. Yeah. Him helping her out or like him doing what he's doing with the money is like having effects either having effect on his business or when his businesses are struggling, it's putting a strain on that whole thing. Yeah, and he's like soft, extorting her in a sense. Like he's kind of like, it would be a real shame if anyone found out about like our arrangement. Like he's a loose end or like a,
yep.
Not a controlled variable. Like he just doesn't have the constitution for this kind of thing. And I think she knows in the back of her head, like this isn't good, but like Luthen, like as he does, accelerates it. Like he's like,
right. Mm-hmm. So she's as she's getting closer to the wedding itself,
mm-hmm.
she's her family's unraveling.
Yeah.
Her clandestine financial dealings are unraveling. Cassian is MIA,
mm-hmm.
which Luthen's worried about, and that's creating tension. And just the way that they would bounce between like conversations with her daughter, conversations with Perrin, conversations with Tay, with conversations with Luthen. Like, I thought that was so, so well done. And it just really, like, you could just feel her, you know, she's just like from the beginning of the episode to the end when she's literally getting drunk and just
yeah.
dancing out of frustration and out of despair. I thought that was just excellent. And the sequence near the end when she has that conversation with Luthen and he says, you know, you're going to need protection. And she's like, well, what does that mean? And he's like, oh, how nice that is for you that yeah. you can just pretend that you don't know what that means.
I don't know what you mean by that. And he's like, nice. That's nice for you. Cause I'm
yeah.
here. Yeah. Like, and he's also kind of keeping her like plausible deniability. Like it was never said, or there's no paperwork or anything that like orders the hit. I'm like, oh, he fell out of a helicopter. Right. She doesn't have her fingerprints on that at all. Right. He made it happen, but like she couldn't have really stopped him. I guess maybe she could have.
No,
like, she like went along with it.
What was she going to do at the wedding? Yeah. Like all of a sudden, like,
yeah.
what is she going to do? She didn't even know.
Right.
I mean, I think that to me, the peak of the entire three episodes was that moment when you see Cinta is the driver. Yeah. To me, yeah. that was the exclamation point on mm-hmm. the whole wedding arc, which is this is
yeah.
like, business, like this is not
like, Godfather. It's like, you know, leave the car, take the cannoli, like it was like that kind of thing. Like, oh no. Or like when you see in like Breaking Bad when like, you know, the one guy, like the fixer assassin guy, or you know, when he's like, when he shows up, you're like, oh, someone's gonna get,
well, this is also just, it's such a like that's how you do those kinds of moments.
Yeah,
all you gotta do is just put the camera on her.
Yeah,
and you know everything that means.
What's happening. Yeah, we know what's
going
to happen.
You know, oh, what he meant when he said you need protection is we're going to kill him today.
Like, yeah.
Gonna we're going to kill him today. Like, mm-hmm. like, and there's nothing you can do about it. And I thought that the way that that unfolded, and as the, you know, you have the music, the loud party music, everybody's dancing, she's drinking, she's getting drunk, and like, and without jumping over to the other storyline, but they all start to fuse together around that music.
Well, and you have symbolically, you have literally like a Death
floating
Star
orb,
like ominously hovering over everything, looming over everything that's happening is this Death Star orb, right? And it looks like the like Darth Maul's assassin droid thing, right? It has like the fins, which are just like the subwoofers, but like, yeah, it's like literally this all seeing eye floating above everything, like. It's just so like poetic and awesome, like that.
Which is also there. It's also interesting that, and we'll get to the Krennic thing, but like,
yeah,
we still don't have a direct. The only direct reference we have to the Death Star in this season one or two is that kind of end credit scene or that last scene where you see that the
what they were doing. Yeah,
right. But nobody, I correct me if I'm wrong, but none of them know about the Death Star.
Yeah, right.
They don't know that that's going on.
Is them like the Death Star
outside of Krennic? No, not that I know.
None of the rebels. None of the Mon Mothma, Luthen. They're not. I don't think.
Oh, yeah, no, not yet.
And I think that that's part of, what, like, so that's, it's still, but it's still, but the stakes are still there, right? Even though we know we're not yet consciously, like, we're going to get there, right? Because we're leading right into Rogue One. And by the time we get to Rogue One, they all know about the Death Star.
Yeah.
But I just thought that the wet, like, that, those sequences, like, when she has that conversation with her daughter,
yeah,
and she basically says, because
really, the daughter's like, "What are you talking about?" Like right before the
when she says, "I wish you were drunk," like that is just like as a mom, like like right before you go out for the ceremony, your daughter's just like, it's basically saying "F you."
Mm-hmm.
Then she finds out that
Tay
is not reliable anymore.
Talking to Skaldin, like. That they're chummier than she thought, and that's really dangerous for them, right?
Yes,
that guy's like connected, and he's like probably got Imperial connections. He's like that really exposes her because he's got leverage over her. Obviously, he knows about her like financial problems or whatnot. He doesn't know that it's like rebellion activity, but like Tay can connect those dots. So he's like he's truly a liability, and like they can't rely on him. He's not like a made man, right? He's like not. He doesn't have the stomach for this kind of thing.
Well, and I think there was a point where Luthen said, like, she said something about, like, she was basically saying, like, I can't believe that he's turning on us. And he's like, that's our job. Like, that's part of this whole thing is, like, you don't, you know, you can't trust people or rely on them to be 100%, you know, in. And by the time she gets to the point, by the time she has the conversation with her daughter, the conversation with Tay, the conversation with Luthen, she is just spinning. Like she's just, her whole world is unraveling. And yet she is the hostess of this big social event for her planet, her culture, her community.
It's like a royal wedding. Like it's like,
It's like a royal wedding that she, and she's there like increasingly having to hold everything in, you know, the pain she has from her daughter's rejection of her, the fear she has of the rebellion getting exposed or her being exposed. And then to add to all that, like she's thinking like, oh, like she's thinks that he might, they might kill her longtime friend.
Yeah. Like she knows
because he's a liability.
Yeah. And did you clock? I clocked at the very end there when she's like really unwinding and unraveling. Like Perrin, they show Perrin and he's like, oh, like he sees her and he's like, are you okay?
That's not
like,
Mon Mothma.
I never see her like this. Like she's not okay right now. He wasn't like, oh yeah, party girl. He's like, oh no, she's like losing it. You know?
Yeah, that, I thought
of a look on his face. Like they really did good with Perrin because like it was kind of scummy last season, but like. I loved his speech. Like he's kind of a likable guy, honestly. Like, but he gets to have like a carefree, like because she's bearing it all, he gets to have some like carefreeness to it. You know, like he doesn't have to, they're not like a team where they're like sharing the load together. He's in the dark, obviously, of what she's up really up to, but you know, he's not a bad guy either. I guess he has like a gambling problem apparently. Right. But that worked.
Well, I think that speaks to what I was saying earlier, which is that none of these, all of these characters are complex.
Yeah.
And they have a side to them all that makes them more than just all good or all bad. In this, I don't mean that, I think there are very clear good guys and bad guys, but it brings a complexity of their humanity into it. And I think that Perrin in that case, right, it's like he's still seen in this episode, these episodes as, you know, a respected member of the Chandrillan community. He has social connections. I think he does love his daughter. I think that he is, he's just, he doesn't share Mon Mothma's convictions or ideals, but he's also not an Imperial. He's just kind of, he's kind of like the person who, you know, it's like, it's like the kind of person that would be like, well, you know, the Nazis are in power. There's not much I can do about that. I could sacrifice everything to try to stop them, or I can just kind of be Sweden.
Yeah.
or play both sides, which is what he does, basically. Mm-hmm. And so there's irony in his speech, because on the one hand, it's very relatable and there's wisdom and truth in it. But on the other hand, he's giving that speech in the backdrop of, you know, and it, I think that's what, that's why the sequences on, is it Minrau or Minarau?
Minarau.
The sequences there are to remind us over and over again, like, the Empire is not just another government or another power structure. They are an evil, oppressive, dangerous, right? Like, and so, Perrin is a likable guy, but he's a likable guy who's ignoring real rising of evil, which is incredibly contemporary. And I think that...
Because, so she, in Rogue One, she's at Yavin and Perrin's not there. Like, I wonder, like, what's going to happen in the next few arcs? Like,
she's gonna lose everything.
She's going to lose everything, or have to walk away from everything. Obviously, we know she gives, like, a big speech in the Senate. I think the third arc is the Gorman thing, because that's to BBY, and that's going to be that year. So I think that's what that is. So I'm not really sure what the next set of episodes will be, but I think that's the third arc. But yeah, I think either in that episode or maybe the next one, like, she gives that big speech and, like, basically, like, calls out Palpatine to his face, like, publicly. And then, like, she has to, like, go on the run. And that's where we see, like, in Rebels, they, like, the Rebels crew, like,
rescues her.
Yeah, she gets extracted by the Ghost crew. In season 3 of Rebels. And I didn't notice it, but that one of the
one of the guys she was talking to
in the Rebels show, like, as her chauffeur. So
yeah, what was that? The one young guy she was talking to.
Yeah, the guy that she was talking to about the parking. He helped her escape. But I feel like they'll kind of fill in that gap later on, like, for, like, one of the arcs. Like, what you're saying is, like, what you're speculating is arc 3 of this season.
Mm-hmm. So, Justin, what was your main, like, takeaway or thoughts on this, like, the Chandrila arc? What impressed you?
So with Andor season 1, anything involving Mon Mothma was kind of a hit or miss. Mainly because of pacing, in my opinion. But this time it actually, I think because of, like, what Aaron's saying, because like, where the contrast is, like, from what they're saying and what actions they're partaking in, on in contrast of what's happening outside of their world, like with Andor and with Bix and everybody else, that there is a kind of sense of ignorance on, like, her environment. So I thought that was like really well done. And plus, like, I feel like it, Mon Mothma is really relatable, as far as juggling with everything and getting to the point of, like, just breaking down because of it.
Like, had a good reason, like, you could let loose at a wedding of your daughter's wedding. It's like it's also a kind of cover story, but, like, she's really going at it and going crazy, but nobody's really like, oh no, it's just like, yeah, you're losing yourself to the rave, and that's, like, that's explainable versus, like, a nervous breakdown any other time. Did Chandrila look like you thought it would? I don't know where they filmed it, but it was kind of a cool, unique-looking location, I thought.
Yeah. Yes. And I don't think I really had any issue with Chandrilla. I mean, I kind of always assumed that it was kind of like Alderaan 0.20.
Yeah.
As far as the books kind of made it sound like, and it delivered. But I was kind of just shocked on like how much lore there was behind that planet. Like the
Remind me, is that the planet that the Starkiller base destroyed in Force Awakens? Or is that No, that was
Hosnian Prime.
Oh, Hosnian Prime, that's right. Okay.
It was supposed to be Coruscant, but they decided against that, and they were hoping to use that for Episode 9.
Yeah,
but that didn't even. But that's like a whole different can of worms. But yeah, I was just kind of surprised with like the lore behind the statues.
Yeah,
that as the wedding gifts. That was kind of cool.
Empire name drop, right? That was cool.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was a great example of world building all around, like from showing like the customs like and
houses
everything.
Of Dune, like one of the like noble houses that would be in that universe, like especially with, like the ceremonies and like they mixed all these like clothing styles and eras and stuff like to come up with like the look of it all, you know. And it looks like a galaxy far, far away, but like also recognizable enough that it's not completely alien. Like Dune maybe pushes it one level beyond that, where like Dune really feels like very alien overall, and less like moral grounded in us. And this is like halfway from like the Expanse, which is like really close, right? Relatively, it's like 300 years out, right? Expanse is very recognizable. Dune is like barely recognizable, and Star Wars is like in the middle. And sometimes it's even more like when they have like analog, you know, switches and buttons, and like they had like a, you know, a 3.5 millimeter headphone jack at one point, and Andor was like plugging into like the communicator thing. I'm like, oh,
right.
Guitar amp. Like, that's how it works. Like they were just kit bashing. They were taking real pieces of real equipment and like,
yeah.
What's his name? The kid from last year, Nemec, he had like a Polaroid camera.
Polaroid.
Like that was like, the navigation device was like a modified Polaroid camera that they like painted. So it's like, but that's like the legacy of Star Wars. Like that's the DNA of like, let's be creative what we have on hand and make it look cool on screen. You know,
I think that the show does a really good job of maintaining that, the gritty or the lived in look that is signature for Star Wars. Yet at the same time, Chandrilla felt very prequel, like very clean, mm-hmm. very elegant, mm-hmm. like Naboo or like mm-hmm. Alderaan and the Kenobi show. And I thought that was perfect. I think that was part of what made it work was that you have Cassian on this like muddy jungle planet and you have the refugees on Mina Rao. And then here's, you know, first class, high class Chandrillan, you know, I was thinking to myself as I was watching, I was like, I think some of these outfits are from Gorm. Like, you know, like,
yeah,
they were showing.
Yeah. Gorman. Like,
there probably had some Gorman mm-hmm. threads going on at the wedding.
So yeah, that's a good transition to like the, let's say Krennic, Dedra, Cyril part, which then that brings in like the Empire part, which is then Mina Rao. But so, yeah. So like it starts obviously with Episode 1 with like, there's this like villainous meeting, right? It's like Dr. Evil's lair kind of thing. An evil hotel conference at the Hyatt or whatever, like a corporate retreat or whatever. With a slideshow presentation, right? With like a tourist video of Gorman.
Oh my gosh.
The spiders.
That was so Space Sweden, perfect. Well, like, the way they set it up, I was just certain it was going to be immediately to the Death Star.
Yeah.
And then they play that corny
promotional
video from like Pure Michigan. It's like, Pure Chandrilla, you know. Yeah. And the way that was so, I think you could make the argument that felt too real world or too like, but I thought that was, I love that, and I loved how it was contrasting
because you're expositing to the characters within the universe, but you're also educating the audience at the same time, right?
Well, but you're also like you like, so first of all, let's just, one thing I wanted to say about the Krennic, that meeting scene, there's a lot of things about that meeting scene that I thought were fantastic. But the first thing is, any concerns I had about Krennic coming back and that actor being in the show, like, that was amazing. Like, he was right there in character. Like, you can feel all of his, you know, like, he even has to name drop. Oh, even Tarkin isn't here. You know, like, I'm the guy.
I just spoke to the Emperor yesterday. Yeah.
Yes. He's like the consummate, like, he's Krennic. Yeah. He's right. Yeah. He's a climber. Mm-hmm. He's got an ego. He's not just an imperial. He's in it for himself. Mm-hmm. He wants to be the guy, right? Which we see that play out in Rogue One. And I thought that was, of all the things we've seen from Krennic in the movie and then in this show, that was my favorite Krennic. I mean, that was like the way that he's just almost like ridiculously, you know, it was over the top, right? Like, and
when Ian McDiarmid does Palpatine in the prequels, he's just like hamming it up, but not in like a too far, like he just goes right to the line of camp and like doesn't go over camp, but like it's full ham, but not camp, right? Like,
right.
He's like relishing this character. It's like just delicious. Like, he's enjoying playing this like evil villain, but not like a Dr. Evil kind of villain. It's like, it's realistic enough, but like, we all know people like that, right? We all like,
yeah, he's, are, like, to me, like that, he's Cyril Karn.
Yes.
But he can back it up.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm Cyril Karn when you actually have power and you're not just
Cyril
pretending.
Ever meets him, he'll have hard eye emojis when he meets Krennic. Yeah. Well, they obviously, they're introducing like this Gorman. The Gorman arc is being like set up here.
It's being launched, yes.
The stakes are like, oh, like they have this like spider that makes the silk and that's their whole economy. But like, they also have this like, you know, unobtainium. They have like the Avatar resource that they need for, which I assume is to like power the Death Star's like engines and whatever. Like, that's what we know. But it's
said it was some, I think it was some kind of material that they were going to use in the super laser.
I think it was Karkite is what they called it. But I think
it was like something that was going to be incorporated there.
It was just like the focusing crystal for the weapon. But I think this Karkite stuff or whatever it's called is like just the raw energy source for like a thing of that size needs to be powered up both to move and operate and then like power the laser. But then like focusing the laser is the crystal, which is what like,
right. But he never says that. He says,
no. Yeah,
this is part of like, Palpatine's
unlimited power and unfree resources and economic growth. Like, it's all just BS, right? Even to these cronies or whatever. But like, we know the audience, like, okay, this guy's full of BS. But like,
he's got,
like,
wants the Death Star done.
Yeah,
and that's his.
But like, obviously, if they're going to be like mining this stuff, it's going to like potentially destroy the planet, like blow it up, even like it could like collapse the planet. And it would cease to exist if they screw it up or whatever, or they would at least have to move the entire population off the planet and like force them out of their land, as it were. And so it's like, how do we do that? Right. And so you have the propaganda guys who are like, oh, we could do X, Y, Z. And then Dedra's got her own plan of like, you need to like basically make the rebels look like the bad guys so that the Imperials can like be the good guys or like have a false flag thing going on or whatever.
That whole sequence, like, it felt like you were watching like you were a fly on the wall for like a Nazi strategy meeting.
Yeah.
And they're very nonchalantly talking about, well, we need this resource from this planet. Probably going to kill everyone. Mm-hmm. How are we going to manage that?
It was like them. It was
like what?
About like, oh, well, let's make all the concentration camps and just gas everyone then casually. And like, okay, now it's time for like, you know,
a snack break.
Like, whoa, like, this is insane. But like, they're so callous and casual about it. But yeah, he like pulls her aside, you know, and like pulls her off this like operation, whatever it was, like where she's trying to find Andor and it's like a goose chase.
She's trying to find Luthen.
Yeah.
And she's been obsessed with that.
Yeah.
For all this time. And now they're like, nope.
She knows there is a guy, like there's an access point for all this. And like Andor was like the link that she lost him at Ferrix. And she's like been on the trail ever since. And it's kind of a dead end at this point. And that's what Partagaz tells her later. Because she's like, I don't really want to do this Gorman thing. I want to focus on this. And Partagaz is like, no, like, this is what you need to do. This is good for your career or whatever. And I think Cyril Karn's going to be involved. Like, their pillow talk.
I think. I thought that it was It was very effective in the sense that it, like, all of that stuff going on, right? Like, and Dedra is, again, another character that's, like, clearly evil. Like, she will torture people. Yeah. She will kill people. She will take away people's homes. She will do whatever it takes. Jesus, but yet, you still, like, there's that sympathy there, right? Like, where she's like, oh, man. And like, you know, there's an element. I don't think they're leaning too heavy into the fact that she's female. I think that is part of it, although it's never really a big part of it. But I think that, like, it's like she's so dedicated. She's such a true believer. She wants to always do her best for the Empire. But yet she does not have the power. Like, she still can't. She has to do what she's told.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's intended to contrast with, like, the conversation that she has with Cyril's mom, where she's like, I'm in charge.
Yeah, that's like the domain where she can exert, like, influence and control and, like, be the alpha. Like, that's why she might be relished to the opportunity to, like, she found someone to pick on her own size, as it were, right? Because she is, like, a small fish in a big pond right now at work, as it were.
Right.
Yeah. I liked the
I thought that was
Coruscant scene with Cyril, where he's, like, showing, like, the new guy.
Oh, my God.
Like, I uncovered or whatever, and then he's just, like, just, like, sucks it in, like, he inhales, like, oh, I'm just really, like, he was, like, almost getting off on, like, the fact that he, like, found, like, uncovered some, like, minor corruption thing, and it's, like, this guy is crazy. He's, like, the full-on Dwight Schrute of this.
He's the guy at your job. He's the kid in the classroom who's like, hey, you forgot to assign homework.
Yeah. Hey, oh, hey, sub. Yeah. You forgot to ask about the homework. Yeah. Yeah. He's that kid. What's wrong with you? Yeah. So then it's funny. Like,
but he does it.
That they're together. They've been like, they're a couple. And I'm like, oh my gosh, they're a couple. This is wild.
But it was also like, again, like, by showing Dedra's home life, like, you know, like, it's so in Star Wars, the Imperials, you never see them at home. You never, right. They're just only on ships and stations and doing Imperial things. Mm-hmm. And here's Dedra, right, who's very much an Imperial, a dyed-in-the-wool Imperial, but she also goes home to her apartment and looks out the window and has a boyfriend.
Yeah, and unsettlingly in the mirror.
Puts an outfit in front of her and tries, oh, will I look good in this? Like, so she's relatable at the same time that she's terrible.
Yeah, like what she did to Bix, right, for example. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she's a terrible person.
To, like, torture that one guy to death, on Ferrix before Bix got in there. Yeah.
Crazy. And I thought that, I mean, we might as well, I mean, so, like, she has to accept the appointment.
Yeah.
Which she does, but we don't get any more of that really in the episodes. But we get the dinner scene with Mama Edie, honestly, like, that whole sequence. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but for me, that was some of the funniest shit I've ever seen. Like, that was absolutely hilarious.
You're dripping, right? And I saw, like, the meme of, like, mother, you're dripping, and then below that I had, like, all of Mon Mothma's outfits for this episode, because she's, like, in drip. Like, she had such good outfits. So it's like, it just works both ways. the looks he was giving her, like, the looks they were giving each other, like, with her talking, like, she's trying to do, like, the passive aggressive thing, and, like, you know, that would have worked normally, but now that Dedra's there, like, she's like, oh no, like, we're going toe to toe on this, and, like, Cyril's just like, he's like looking at her, like getting more and more turned on basically by Dedra, because she's like standing up for him. It's
so crazy. Well, I thought
take a quick power nap.
to pull that, there's two things about that scene that I think are so cool. Well, number one is it is almost entirely a comedic part of the episode.
Yeah.
But it is consistent with what we saw in season one from her mom, his mom, and Cyril. It is so relatable. Like, right? Oh, you're going to meet your in-laws, right? And, you know, it's the, and I don't know if you know, but this woman, the woman who plays Edie, she was in another movie where she plays just a absolute monstrous mom.
That's funny.
I mean, like in a, it's almost like a horror movie, and she's like this crazy person. But that the perf like to pull off all three component that thing, for that whole thing to work, all of them have to, like, the comedic timing, the facial expressions, the lines, the tension, like, that's not easy to pull off.
Apparently,
and,
like,
and to pull it off in a serious show, like, it's a very serious show.
Cyril doing like the nap thing, that was like ad-libbed, or like that wasn't in the script or anything, and like the director kept pushing that out to the dailies to Tony Gilroy, and he hated it at first, and then like when he saw it all in context, he's like, oh yeah, you're right, that should be in there, that's hilarious.
Like, oh, that was Cyril, oh my God.
Came up with that of like, I just need like a mental health break for a second, like he's like overwhelmed with like the situation, and he's like has to take a break, and then he
And the absolute beauty of that sequence, right, is that you are like fist pumping for Dedra in that scene. You're like, tell her, somebody put that bitch in her place.
I can guarantee you a level of engagement, but it'll be inversely proportional to the amount of anxiety or stress you cause us. I'm like, yeah, the boundaries. Yeah, good. This is
That's like, it's brilliant. But like, but the whole time you're like, I was thinking when I was watching that, I'm like, these are flashes of her imperial dark side, you know, and she's it is
her, like she does to everyone else. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she's ruthless. but my gosh, I mean, it's just, it is what it is. Like, it was just so funny. Oh my goodness. I didn't think as I was watching it, and I'm like, it just got funnier and funnier and funnier. And I was like, is this going to work? Is this working? It is working. Yeah. Why am I not like being taken out? Like it is a very a stark tone contrast from the rest of the show. But you know, the reality is that that's probably a good, like you need some of that release of tension.
Yeah.
Because the rest of the show is incredibly heavy and dark.
The rest of that episode. Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I guess that brings us to the Mina Rao arc. So this is a wheat biome, right? Star Wars Nebraska, and Brasso Wilhelm, who's the kid who threw the bomb, and his dad got
died. Oh yeah, yep.
Or died, either died in the riot or died in interrogation or something. Anyway, I think he died in interrogation. That's what made him like make the bomb and throw the bomb. And Brasso like saved him in the riot, and so they're like a little crew with Bix, and then like Bix and Cassian are married now, apparently, right?
And are they?
Well, yeah. She told the Imperial like my husband, but I think they are together or married.
Together.
I think so, in some way. Obviously Cassian's like off on a mission for a few days, but he's like late, right? So like they're dealing, like the situation they have is like, they're like, you know, undocumented labor. They're like mechanical workers. They're like itinerant, you know, nomadic laborers but they're working for this like farmer, right? Who runs like the shop and has a farm, and they like repair his, you know, mechanical stuff. And then like Willem is like, you know, dating their daughter, like against the wishes and so on. It's like the kind of pastoral village life kind of.
It reminded me. There were hints of Inglourious Bastards. Very much of like the French Revolution, like, you know, the French resistance. Yes, and the way that it was portrayed, even like the girl who Will was in love with, like, she just seemed French to me for some reason, like the way she looked.
French villager girl, the farm girl.
But
like. Yeah, so
essentially,
like,
they're in hiding
and everything, and they like locked on the planet like for information. Like, you can't get any like transmissions in or out, which is why nobody, like Leda can't reach in, Bix can't get a message out, Cassian can't get a message in. Like, it's like lockdown. No one knows what's going on down there. But they're like doing like an audit, right? Which is probably part of like Porg, right? Or the poured, the public order resentencing directive thing, right? That's the thing that got Cassian in trouble. Like, they're like cracking down more and more on stuff, right? And like selectively deporting or whatever, getting rid of, you know, people. And like, the everyone's like trying to stay ahead of, like, where are they going to go next? Like, we got to like stay out of the way of the Imperials as they're inspecting everything. And like, the crew is like making plans to leave, even though Cassian's not there. They're like going to try to leave. And that, I love their little, like, their house they live in is like, you can tell it like folds up to like fly away. It has like a cockpit, and when it lands, it's like a camper, like a pop-up camper, and like the sides pop out like accordions. Like, they designed that thing to like look like it would actually work. Like, I thought it was a cool, like, their little house is like a mobile home, but it like flies, right? It's like a trailer. So it's like the idea of like a Dust Bowl, Grapes of Wrath, like vibe, as what I was getting, and the Great Depression kind of era, even like kind of the clothes and like the way they kind of all looked, and they like, had like the, you know, the bucolic, like, open air, big long table, big long picnic table, communal meal thing. Like, it's like, oh, the calm before the storm, like, it's all gonna hit the fan, you know? But yeah, so like at the Imperial, like the creepy rapey Imperial guy, right? He's come sniffing around, like being a creep. Like, Brasso shows up and he like backs off immediately because Brasso is just this physical presence, right? Which comes into play later, obviously. But like, yeah, so like that's like your like Chekhov's gun moment where you're like, oh, this is he's gonna try again, this guy, right? This guy's not good, right? And he's, but then they, even when he's like going, when he does like make his attempt, he starts with the conversation, like, he, I guess, more or less correctly points out like an interesting dilemma of like, you know, like the farmers need the labor, and like the rules are the rules, but like the situation requires nuance. And it's like, that's very like on the nose and relevant, and like that says something like to today. Like, this is a situation.
Oh, I mean, it's right out of the headlines of today.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, like, but obviously they didn't, I mean, they wrote this like years ago, but like, but it also has just always been a story, right? It's just like, yes, the way things are. Like, you always have, whenever you have like an occupying government or like a like imposing government or whatever, because these seem like they were like freehold farmers, like it's like a co-op or something. It's not like, they're not like corporate farmers, or like they're just like regular people just like homesteading, right, on some planet, obviously like a breadbasket planet. And the guy's like, why can't they just leave us alone, right? Like, the farmer that they work for is kind of like, you know, like a anarcho-capitalist, you know, libertarian kind of guy, like a yeoman farmer, just like, leave us alone, right? And so how do you interpret, because I had one take on the first watch, and then when I watched the third episode again, I got it then, because I had the wrong take on the first go. So like, at first, when like, it's like when it's starting to hit the fan, and like Brasso gets caught, right, and then he gets brought to the store, then he like, you know, he like lashes out at Kellen, but Kellen had been, or Keller, what is it, the farmer, their boss, he had been like, he's been shown to be kind, they're friendly with him, like, he's friends, he's like looking out for him, he's even talking about like, he's like kind of referring to Luthen, is like, oh, have you heard from like the big boss yet, or like he's like a proto rebel, like he's in the mindset of like, I want to help, like somebody needs to do something about this, like somebody needs to know about like what the Empire is doing. So he's like somewhat of a potential rebel asset, right? But then like so quickly, like Brasso like flips on him and like flips out on him. And at first I thought, like, I was like, oh, did this get dark? Where like, so like they have the rapey boss over there with Bix, but like are the underlings like doing stuff with like his wife and his daughter in that shop, right? And like this guy, this poor farmer is like caught of like, if he wants to like, they're like, hey, if we stop doing that, will you like bring out the people you have working for you, right? Like, I thought like they had like leverage over him, and he like gave up Brasso under duress, right? That's what I first thought was happening, and I was like, man, they're really going there. But like, now, and then the second viewing, I realized like, oh, like, no, Brasso was like, he was being a
covering for him,
he was being a complete like wingman. So he was like making it look like to the Imperials that oh, you just use us up and whatever. So he's like creating a fire gap so that guy might have a chance. So that all the blame goes on Brasso. So he like heroically basically sacrificed himself, because he kind of probably could tell where this was going no matter what. And he's like a real life Chewbacca, right? He's like a human Chewbacca of like just a real loyal bro, you know? And then that it just hits even harder, because like that's so consistent with his character. I just love Brasso the whole show up to this point. Like, he's had such a good run of like, he's, you know, that's who Cassian entrusted his mother to. He entrusted B2 Emo to, that's who like carried the brick, right? That's who smashed the brick of Marva into the Imperial's face, right? He Cassian entrusted Bix to her, right? this guy and like this Will kid, like they adopted this kid basically. Like he's just like, I got big dad energy, you know. It's like, I love that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And they hit.
I thought that was definitely what was going on. I don't think he turned them in.
Yeah.
But it was in the expressions. It's
convincing of a performance. Like he did too good of a job. Where I was like, oh man, like I bought it. You know, like I bought what he was selling, just like the Imperials did.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that obviously, without jumping too far ahead, that's what makes his death so tragic, right? Yeah. Like he was self-sacrificing
mm-hmm.
to the end,
and making a beeline for Bix. Like he knew Bix was in trouble, and he was like, "I got the first chance of the first distraction I get. I'm taking my shot mm-hmm. to like go save her again, right? Because he already stepped in and kind of saved her before that got too heated. Because that guy could have probably taken a shot in that little like shed earlier, right? So he's like heading straight for Bix, but that he knew like if this doesn't work, I'm dying because they're gonna hit me. And they even showed like the one stormtrooper like taking a second, and you could tell that was the shot, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stormtrooper action, uh-huh. You know.
I thought that the sequence went
through the scope.
Yeah, he actually went through the scope. Yeah.
Well, I think I made a comment when we were watching it, like because when they were all surrounding Brasso, like right there at close range, and they were all pointing at him, and I was like, they might still miss. Yeah. Like, because they had him like right there, like they surrounded him yeah. and they were all pointing their guns at him. And I was almost waiting for like some kind of joke about, you know, like, are they going to be able to shoot him if they need to?
Can't even do
or if they did start shooting, they would all shoot each other because they're all facing each other.
Now, do you think I was reminded, I don't know if this was intentional, but like I was getting big, like, Nazis and Raiders of the Lost Ark vibes from like the Imperial military's like outfits and like their vehicles. Like it was very like Nazis in Egypt, right?
Yeah, that whole sequence.
Like, oh, yeah. Like,
it was very
much very like, World War II.
Yes.
It was very like, World War II.
Like you know, Germany occupying Northern Africa
yeah.
or France or anywhere, like pick your
yep.
it's like the axis of evil is like rolling through Europe or whatever and just
yep.
exerting their influence and doing whatever they want with impunity, right? Because they've got the big guns and whatever on just innocent people. And too, I just love like the grain silos, like they just like we have those things here, but they just literally just turn them upside down to make them like work like those like big battle droid, like you know, those like balls that like
go
the Lucre class hull things. Like you can tell
yeah.
like
oh yeah uh-huh.
they just like float up back to the atmosphere, like that's how they get them in and out. But it's like it's just so smart just to like flip it around and make it look, it's like so familiar but like so it looks so Star Wars because you just gotta like, look at it just like a little bit of a twist. It's like you recognize that immediately is like, oh yeah, that's like a grain refinery, but it's not like anyone yeah. we've seen on Earth, but it's just so cool.
I thought that the what's that?
Well, it kind of just reminds me a little bit of home because I live like right next to like some farms, so mm-hmm. Those big silos are that was like a pretty cool touch to it, and plus like that one scene like where the stormtroopers get completely buried by them,
yeah, right?
By like the they make it look like it hurts, and I can mm-hmm. guarantee you if that did happen, it would hurt.
Yeah, and like the HUD display like shows the three dots like disappear, like. They all like because it's
yeah.
measuring if you're alive or not. So yeah, obviously yeah, Cassian like he arrives to save the day just in time in this cool TIE fighter. They figure out how to fly, and then he's just like just wasting everybody with like the cool like missile shot on the ship or like so that truck was like heading to like this lieutenant who's in distress, right? The colonel or the corporal and the lieutenant who's like in the process of assaulting Bix, like calls in reinforcements, and like so Cassian. Maybe unintentionally. He obviously didn't know the situation, but he's like, oh, I see Imperials. I'm going to shoot them with a missile. Yeah. And like, that probably saved Bix's life because like she wouldn't have lasted him. Because Will came to save the day too. Like, so it's just 2 against 8, right, at that point. But he like leveled the playing field. And then that's how they could get out. But first he noticed, yeah, he knows Brasso, like his ship had been, or his speeder had gotten, you know, hit. But like, yeah, he's just using the cool tools, like that cool, like the controls of that thing is so cool, like the heads up display, and he's like targeting, like all the targeting of like hit your
total video like, game, video yeah, game shots there. So
that's your like pew yeah. pew part where you're like, yeah, like whiz bang, this is great. That TIE fighter is just so cool.
I thought that the whole sequence on that planet from beginning to end
mm-hmm.
was the part that just generally, like, right, like you can just feel like, because like the way it looks peaceful, it looks so, you know, communal and familial and simple and everything. And you can just feel like that sequence, that part of the arc was the part that drives home, like it goes, it just, you can just feel the vise tightening, you know, and it's happening on this like larger level of just like the imperial occupation, but it narrows down all the way to Bix and that agent and one
I
person.
guess that's like a metaphor for the whole thing, basically.
Yes, like the way and the tension that that creates as number one, right? They're like, oh shit, we gotta make a run for it. Like
Yeah,
these
like the noose
four
is tightening, so you
people.
gotta escape. So there's tension right there, like narratively, to have like the circles and
Yeah,
curves.
and it's and it happens it to me that and the wedding, like right, like it just it's just slowly, right? Like the tension is ratcheting, and then it's like that's why I think that the scene with Bix worked. And we can talk about, you
Well,
know,
and it worked for
the
me like immediately. Like my first thought, especially when that guy started, like I was like, I clocked this guy immediately, like what he's after. Like this is not a safe person, right? This is a snake of a guy. And I'm like, my first thought was like, fear will keep them in line, right? Like it's like the Tarkin doctrine worked its way all the way down to like the line of like the lieutenants. Like the guy is like, I'm gonna use fear as a tool, right, to keep everyone afraid of the Empire and like use whatever power I can. So like if it's Tarkin, it's a big space laser. And if it's this guy, it's a different kind of laser, right? Like it's the same philosophy. Like we're just gonna from the top, like leadership at the top sets the tone all the way down the chain of command, right? That's why I thought like if they have like your lieutenant is like this, and you know this is not the first time he's done this, you know this is not the first time the driver's taken him out somewhere and is like, oh, I don't even know what my boss is doing, la di da di da, right? You know that's not the first time that's happened. And then like that's where I was like, oh, these other like the sergeant, like everyone else, they left at the store, like they would feel like, oh, I can do whatever I want now too, like I can go raping and pillaging because the boss does it, right? Like you know that's the vibe, and then you know that's repeated everywhere, right, across the galaxy, right? And like that just gives you a
Right.
picture of like what we're dealing with here.
Well,
It's
and
all.
what it does is it takes all of that feeling of like the oppression of the Empire and drives it all the way down to that intimate scene
Just
where
somebody who just cannot
here's
catch
this,
a break. This poor Bix has just been through so much.
yeah,
They're just
and
like,
she's and
oh,
That is what fascism and authoritarian, right? It ultimately, at the end of the day, it's ultimately we can do what we want with your body. We can tell you where to go, where not to go. We can tell you who to be with, who not, and like you feel that the
We can
whole
control you.
time, but it comes all the way down to this scene, which just is, you know. Not that we didn't already know that the Empire was terrible. We already know that. I mean, they blow up whole planets full of people. But for some reason, and I heard people talking about this, like blowing up Alderaan in Star Wars is almost like an act. Like it doesn't even. There's no. It just happens, and then we move on to this in the story. But with the scene with Bix, it's like that's real trauma. Like that's. You know, one-on-one trauma. And it's, you know, that's what that kind of behavior that commanding officer was doing, that's what that system
It's a tool of
promotes.
war, and that happens. That's happening right now, like in Sudan. Like that is a weapon of war, and it's always been the case, right? This is standard operating procedure for an oppressive system or an oppressive empire or an oppressive group trying to like exert influence or exert control over another group.
Or even on just a very basic level, it's like, I mean, you always hear stories about how, like, it isn't necessarily, I mean, yes, sometimes sexual assault is a weapon of war, or it's just, well, I can take what
Yeah,
I
you have
want
the
and
power.
just
Yeah,
get my
you're
jollies
yeah.
because no one can stop me,
No one can stop
which is,
me.
I got more of that vibe from him where he's like,
Like
because he's
he knows
honestly
that he's in
like,
trouble.
He's, I mean, I'm being a little bit crass here, but that's probably the only way that guy gets laid.
Yeah, you know, yeah, well, like, for sure. Well, because at first he tried to, like, ask her on a date, like, oh, let's go to the big city. And then, like, when she was like, no, thanks, he didn't take no with a hint. He's just like, okay, well, I'm going to get what I want now. Right? Like, yikes.
Right.
That's like every woman's the worst name to a guy like that, right?
So and I thought that the
second that, like, when, so, like, when he stopped for Brasso to, like, see, to, like, he was on his way to Bix, but then he, like, diverted to, like, I was worried that, like, because he stopped there, and then I was like, when he gets to that place, it's going to be, like, Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru, like, he's going to find, like, Bix and Will, like, just completely, like, roasted or killed, like, and then,
yeah,
like, that he'll be, like, it'll be, like, his Luke Skywalker moment. He's like, there's nothing left for me, like, I need to, like, go all in on the rebellion, like, it's cost me everything, like, with the speech he gives to Jen or so, about, like, you have no idea, like, what this has cost me, right? Like,
right, which it may still cost him.
I think Bix is going to die in one of these, and I think Will is going to die in another one. I think he's going to lose everybody by the end of this thing, right? That's why
they're real good K too.
I thought it was all going to be at once. I thought, like, he's going to lose Brasso and then his wife, and then it was going to be like this brutal, like, fiery death, or like a, because, like, maybe, like, maybe if he hadn't shot that, like, that transport, and, like, he didn't know that the transport was coming, like, we with the audience would know that, like, even though, like, she killed the officer, right, the reinforcements are coming, and, like, that's not going to be good for them. And, like, I thought it was going to be, like, even more tragic. But, like, yeah, luckily they got off the planet, the three of them, right, and they're going somewhere. We don't know. You know, they'll jump another year, but.
Well, I also, I was, so I don't know, like, I guess we can talk about this. I think it's worth talking about, like, right, because I know I heard rumors about that there was going to be a sexual assault scene in the show, and some people were, like, out of their minds, like, that's crazy, that's terrible, that shouldn't happen in Star Wars, I'm totally against that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what the scene was going to be. It was obviously unprecedented in Star Wars.
She said the word right. That's never been said in Star Wars. You tried to rape
but this was my impression of the scene. He was not successful.
No, right.
He
right.
never actually he raped her.
Yeah, right.
He attempted, and then she beat the shit out of him,
mm-hmm.
and then effectively killed him indirectly.
He got the wrench on his head, and that'll
yeah, which to me was a very strong, like, you know, because the whole
right
Min Rao arc starts with her having that nightmare about the guy who tortured her.
That's a good point. That's the first, like, one of the very first things we see in the first couple minutes.
Yes.
Of the entire thing is, like, Dr. Gorse is there. I'm like, oh, like, I had, like, a visceral reaction to that guy. I was like, oh,
but yeah, it was like a horror. It was a bit of a horror vibe.
Oh, it's like, so creepy. Yeah.
And I thought that I thought that what made that scene work in Star Wars was that she was like, fuck you. You're not raping me up.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. It, like, was earned. That, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And she found the strength to fight back, even though she had been completely subdued by them in season one when she was captured and interrogated and tortured.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was very powerful and very positive.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like, no, you can't take what you want.
Some parts of Game of Thrones were just like Joffrey just being sadistic, right? Like why? Right? You're just, like, committing violence against women for not even plot reasons. Like, it's like it's all about the context. It's like, oh, we're gonna have a rape scene in Star Wars. Like, everyone's like, oh, that's terrible. But it's like, well, you gotta, like, look at the context, and, like, it has to be, like, how is it handled? Like, what's the point of it? What's the resolution of it? Versus, like, are we, like, is it just titillating? Right? That's bad, right? If it's, like,
yeah,
I mean, like, it's not, like, glorious. It's not, like, celebrating it. It's not, like, condoning it. It's, like, presenting it for what it is. And the bad guy gets his confidence, right? Like, everything happens, like, the fairy tale happens in the sense that, like, the bad guys lose, the good guys win, right? Like, it's not inverted. It's not like, oh, evil wins today or whatever. It's not like, why are we watching this, you know? It had a purpose.
And well, I think
you know, it was like PG-13 level, you know, like, violence.
But it was to be clear, like, I've heard people talking about, like, like, apart from the scene where Anakin gets his legs cut off and goes up in flames, I don't think there's ever been a more, for lack of a better expression, adult or mature, like, where it's like, this isn't for kids.
Yeah, like, for sure.
Yes. Yeah, like, oh, younglings, but.
I mean, like, the closest you get is, like, in this era, like, I was thinking it's, like, Hunchback of Notre Dame, right? Like, the priest in that, or like the cardinal guy, like the bad guy in that movie, is kind of similar to this guy. And like, that he wants to assault her, Esmeralda or whatever. And they don't show something like that, but like, this takes it one step farther than that. But like, it's within the Disney umbrella. It's like, it's material that they've covered in other ways, in different ways before, but like, it's not HBO either, right? It's like they,
and you know, I thought that they struck it just right. Like,
yes,
nobody's clothes came off. Nobody, you know, it was just, it was very clear what was happening.
Yeah.
But he was unsuccessful. She fought back. She put him in his place. And
I cheered when she like used that like gun to like shoot the other guy. Cause he like distracted by, well, like, remember, like she just like shot.
Yeah.
Used that few seconds to like shoot him. And then I was like, oh, phew. Yeah. Go girl. You know, like,
yeah. I mean, yeah. I think that it's valid to say though. I think that I understand why some people would be like, do we want to cross that threshold in Star Wars or not? I can understand because Star Wars is thoroughly, you know, PG family friendly,
or like Leia's bikini.
Lots of things in
life, right?
Well, genre. I mean yeah. There's a lot of people refer to that,
yeah,
and the fact that maybe in other sources it is implied that Leia was sexually compromised potentially,
or even that other dancer, but, like said to the Rancor, like that's heavily implied that she would do anything was, out of that situation, right? Even like potentially risk getting Rancored, right? Just because she's chained to Jabba and you can't take it anymore. Like that's heavily implying like what's going on there, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, if you're going to make a decision to either, you know, you could make a decision to just not go there in any Star Wars content, and that's fine.
Yeah.
I don't think you need that to drive home how ominous and dastardly the Empire is. But they did decide to go there. It's definitely not for kids. Like, I can't imagine if a kid was watching that, they probably wouldn't even understand what was going on.
Yes, right. It would,
depending on how old they are, and it would just come across as
hurt her, right? Which is true enough. That's all they really need to know. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was just an appropriate. It took it up a notch from what we've seen before, but it knew how far to go.
And because like Bix is not in Rogue One, like there's real peril for some of these characters. Like the ones we know don't die in Rogue One are expendable in this season. So it's like, I actually don't know how that's going to turn out. Like
we don't see any of them in Rogue One.
You know, the main character's not going to die. We know that. Like it's too early in the movie for them. But like in this show, it's like, man, anybody can die at any minute who we know doesn't
survive. We expect all of them to die because none of them are in Rogue One.
Yes. If you're not in Rogue One, I'm writing you off as dead at some point in the season. Until proven otherwise, you know, and like, when's it going to happen is like the suspense part of it and how, that's wild. But
that is what would make Rogue One so great.
Maybe go much longer, before. Oh, it okay. But, we did cover everything, which is good.
we didn't talk about that I wanted to mention was that, through all three episodes and all three arcs, with the exception of like maybe the Dedra and Cyril, like that was just not fully developed. But in all of the arcs of the story, the main characters like Mon Mothma, Cassian when he's on Yavin, the refugees on the farm planet, There's a consistency of how those storylines are like. It starts with everybody, well, the exception of Cassian, but even with Cassian, like, yeah, he's in a dangerous mission, but everything's going according to plan. And then slow, like I thought, what worked with every arc, and that's why, like, at the like yeah,
things fall
by
apart.
The end,
yeah,
when it all kind of rises and falls. In synchronicity, and then the end when I loved how like the thought the scene that just made me realize how well done all three episodes were was when the music was playing, the wedding music was playing,
yeah,
and you're watching Mon Mothma, And then it cuts to them in the TIE fighter, just devastated.
Yeah.
Brasso is dead. The music is still going, and you almost can't hear it. Yeah. Like, it weaves it all together, like, so well that, like, even though the music isn't a fit in all the other parts of the show, like, at the end, like, it doesn't take away from, like, the somberness of the moment after Brasso dies when they have to make a run for it. Like, it's
almost, well, like, almost like the juxtaposition of, like, rave music at a funeral, right? Like, it highlights.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
Well, there's, like,
and that,
party music.
That proves, like, you, to be able to kill off a main character like that and have all the other characters so devastated, and that doesn't get lost at all while this dance music is playing, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And to me, that coupled with the way that we talked about it briefly, but, like, I just want to make sure that, like, that sequence where Cinta picks up
Tay,
and you just see it. They
show them driving away or whatever.
They show them driving away. There's no, like,
he has no idea what's happening. Yeah.
That was so well executed, and just like, by the time you get, I always try to, like, when I'm looking at a movie or a show or anything, like, you never really know if they're doing a good job until you get to the end. Like, the example I always use is the movie Whiplash, which I don't know if you guys have seen.
Yeah.
But, oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like, you get to the end of that movie, and, like, every time I watch it, even though I know the story, like, the movie ends, and then I go, oh. And that's how I felt.
Why are you sweating?
Yes. By the end, like.
Why is my heart racing?
You're just. and to me, that is what, for me personally, obviously, in my opinion, it was successful. Like, it. If I'm feeling what I think they're trying to get me to feel, and I feel it, like, without even thinking about it, like, I'm just there experiencing it. For me, that's what happened. And that means somebody's doing their job. Like, that's, and the feeling of, like you're feeling what they're feeling in the cockpit, you know? You're feeling what Mon Mothma is feeling, you know, and how they just, like, you, by just constantly bombarding us with that music while we're carrying all of this heavy stuff. And that's exactly what Mon Mothma is experiencing. The music is blaring, the noise, the activity. And yet in her soul is this heaviness, this terrible heaviness that she's carrying. And we're there carrying that, you know, hearing the dance music, seeing what's happening to everyone. I just thought that was so good. So good.
All right. So then we'll have the next arc is this week. And I think that's the arc that has, like, Cassian has, like, the drip with the sunglasses. I think that's that, but that might be the Gorman. Cause it's like, he has, like, a sniper rifle at some point. I think that's the Gorman arc. So I don't actually know for sure.
He has, like, an Elvis, like, hairdo, and, like, he's like,
I was, like, trying to think of, like, all the trailer footage and, like, filter out everything that's from these first three, right? And, like, what's left, right? And it's, like, a few little snippets. Like, a lot of the trailer stuff was from this first arc.
My phone's about to die. Like,
the entire, like, back half of the season is, like, a kind of a mystery, which is kind of fun. And apparently it gets just even crazier. Like, they, like, the first half is good, and the second half is phenomenal. It's, like, great. Is what people do.
The second half of the season?
Yes. They're, like, the last six episodes are just high adrenaline, insane. Like, I want to see him, like, stealing Y-wings. I want to see him, like, you know, like, I want to see, like, all kinds of stuff at the end there.
But, well, we're headed into, like, from a Star Wars timeline or canon perspective, some major events.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, that really are truly, like, part of Star Wars history and lore. Yep. Like, and that is very exciting. Like, yeah. And I think that I know that there's the, you know, the stream of thought out there that, you know, there's no Jedi, there's no lightsabers, this isn't Star Wars, so on, so on. But I mean, the reality is like, what, I mean, there, you know, that's the period of time we're in. There's no Jedi, there's no Jedi Council, there's no Jedi Knights, there's no, there's just,
the first Star Wars movie was about the rebellion, and it happened to have
Jedi
Knight and a very, very young Jedi in training who barely knew anything. But like, that's like, the focus of it. And like, it's barely, there's just the Vader and Obi-Wan fight, but it's otherwise like rebels against an empire. Like, that's the core story of Star Wars. Yeah.
And I think that getting a full treatment of that backstory between this show and Rogue One is, I mean, a lot of people have said like Rogue One to them was, you know, the best Star Wars that's been done since Disney took over. And, you know, I think the what makes this show for me still very much Star Wars is that it is firmly in the narrative of the story. Like,
yeah,
it's not Skeleton Crew, entirely unrelated. It's the heart of the story.
All right, so that'll wrap it up then. We'll be back after the next arc drops on Tuesday night. Probably next weekend we'll record, and we will see who we can get from the crew for that. Thanks for joining us, Justin. I'm glad you can make it.
Yeah, same here. A little tired, but I made it.
Yeah. We'll definitely have a recording about a recapping your trip to Celebration in Japan, so that we want to hear a full debrief of that for sure.
Oh, definitely.
All right, so until next time, the Force will be with you always.
Always.
Great shot, kid. That was one in a million.